Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Sally O'Cordy, and welcome to Public Advocate. Today, I read on my Facebook page a message, a happy birthday message from Dottie Mintline. And in this birthday message, she has created the absolutely best slogan I have ever heard for this fight. We are fighting for truth, health, and medical sanity. Yeah, that's a battle cry. Truth, health, and medical sanity. I really like that. But I also found out this morning when I woke up on Twitter from Kara and from somebody who calls themselves Liberty News that they're going to be spraying for the Zika virus today. I just want to say, in New York City in particular, although I just got a message from someone in Maryland who said that they'll be spraying there too, but I just want to say the last time they sprayed, oh, and by the way, on the television they said, although we have not seen one case of Zika, not one, okay, the last time they sprayed it was for West Nile virus, and I live in Queens, and you know, I remember not knowing what the heck they were spraying and probably wasn't going to be good for children, so calling my sister and telling her to keep the kids in the house, you know, until it was well over. And they're saying in Maryland, you have to determine when it's safe for children and animals to go outside again. What, do we all have test kits I don't know about? So anyway, after they used to spray for the West Nile virus, they, you walk down the street and there were all these dead birds, all these birds on their backs. It was horrifying. They were killing our birds. And it was just kind of, you know, left you with a really bad feeling that all these beautiful animals were needlessly slaughtered for something that, you know, probably didn't exist. So I'm going to pick up my friend Travis Middleton, who was introduced to me by Candace Estave, and I'm very eager to hear what he has to say. Hello, Travis Middleton. Welcome to the program, Public Advocate.
Good morning, Sally. How are you today?
I chose this particular program because you are, in fact, advocating, and we're very eager to hear what it's about. The name of the show is The Lawsuit Against Richard Pan. So I hope I have everyone's attention, and I'm sure I do.
Should I go ahead and start, Sally?
You just take off. Lay it all out. Tell people where it's at, everything you've been working on. I'm eager beyond eager to hear it.
Okay. You know, since I got involved in this event and discussion and activity since this past February or March of last year, I had all along understood how to deal with this issue with Richard Pan and SB-277. And my first reaction was to sue these guys under the Hobbs Act for what they're doing. And I couldn't get not one attorney to agree with that premise. Everyone talked about doing referendums, petitioning your legislators somehow to figure out some way to block this bill. And it's my understanding, you know, based upon what these politicians have done over the years, not just in California, but nationwide, even in Congress, they really don't care what we think, what's going on with public policy and the laws of the state, or however they you know, want to make those laws, or to what effect those laws affect on us. They don't care.
Absolutely agree with you there. Absolutely agree with you there.
So, you know, and so the question is, in my mind, to try to educate people, how do we tilt the scales of balance back in our favor as citizens, away from the commercial and industry and those corporations who are funding their campaigns. It's difficult, from my perspective, to educate the common citizens about that issue because, one, most of us aren't educated about how our country really works with respect to a vote and how laws are made. We're clueless, you know, and no one's educating us on how this stuff works. So, I don't want to spend too much time on that aspect of it. I want to kind of cover that base so that other of your listeners can know where I'm coming from. And I'm under the belief that your vote doesn't matter because of the corporate fraud involved behind the scenes with these legislators and those corporate funders. So that's just my belief based on what I've discovered over the years. I won't go into that either. So absent voting them out of office and holding a picket sign and rallying around Sacramento or Congress to try and petition them, saying, look at us, we're displeased with what you're doing, you know, blah, blah, blah. They don't care because they see us as peons, like in the little cartoon, The Bug's Life. When we realize there are hundreds of thousands, millions of us and only a few of them, and when we realize our true rights and capacities and immunities about how to invoke our power, then and only then will we start to make the changes we desire. For an example, pursuant to the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, we have a right to what's called redress of grievances under the First Amendment. Most of us do not know what that means. So when I talked about going to the courts and suing the legislators, people thought I was a madman, most of them. And then attorneys didn't get it or didn't understand what that was about. Well, you know, the courts belong to us too as citizens. Pursuant to the First Amendment, we have a constitutional right to petition the courts, redress of grievance, and use those courts to secure or demand or purge any unlawful activity by legislators or anybody else for that matter. Again, a lot of us don't understand that piece because we haven't used it and no one has taught us that. The attorneys go to law school to learn how to become an officer of the court. Their first duty is to the court, not the client. So, you know, they have careers to uphold and they have aspirations to seek, like maybe a higher office. So a lot of them, either one, do not know, fully understand our caste judicial system. And two, if they do understand, they do not want to get their hands that dirty to sue a politician because they may run for office themselves one day, or they may be closely tied either professionally or personally to one of the legislators' corporations or them personally. So I get it. It's going to boil down to where your allegiance is. So let me segue from that into lawsuit aspect of it. For the last, I guess, since this past November, there's been talk about who's going to sue the legislators and how they're going to stop this bill and what's going on with the children who are going to have to be vaccinated to get into school. And all these different discussions. Well, the first thing along those lines is, you know, the issue with the schools and the children. I've heard the term and the discussion around, well, California's Constitution promises that all children of this state a right to an education, a free education, and that is true. Under, I believe, Article 9, Section 5 of under our California Constitution talks about what it provides for a free education for all children. Now, what that means is no cost to your education. Now, that issue has got nothing to do with allowing children into school, whether they be unvaccinated or vaccinated. So unless the courts have that argument, that statutory guideline, into a liberal First Amendment issue, then there's nowhere in our California Constitution that says they have to allow kids in schools if they're unvaccinated or if they're vaccinated. That the wording of that is not in that statute under our Constitution mandate. And so in my lawsuit against Richard Penn, before I bring any legal claim, I make sure I do the research statutorily. Does the language fit the violation, or does the case law support the violation? Excuse me. So, and I thought about using that as an argument. So when I went and looked at the California Constitution provisions for what I was being led to believe, that children allowed a free education or they were being discriminated because of their vaccination rates, nothing can be further from the truth. So, yes, they do have a First Amendment right to go to school without being discriminated against, whether they're vaccinated or unvaccinated. But the argument about under California's Constitution, whether that provision, Article 9, Section 5, refers to a right to free education that has been morphed into the vaccine issue, is just not there. Okay? So I posited the argument along the lines of California has also a mirrored image of our First Amendment it's Article 1, Section 9, I think, that talks about religious freedoms and the right to be to exercise your religious beliefs, which mirrors our federal First Amendment rights under the First Amendment. So they're almost identical. So I used that one instead. Under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, there is the issue of discriminatory practices by the state due to this lack of vaccine issue. So that's a 14th Amendment issue in federal court. So now I'll move into the lawsuit issue. I've spoken with
What does the 14th Amendment say?
The 14th Amendment is the provision that all states that are states of the Union of America under our United States Constitution, pursuant to the 14th Amendment, have agreed to the protection of all rights of all its inhabitants, all of its citizens, under all the laws of their equal protection rights. Okay, it's like a double-edged sword. It's a duality bill that states that no person can be discriminated against for lack of class, gender, age, that sort of thing. Okay, plus every state must protect every citizen's rights under the law as well. So there's a discriminatory aspect of the 14th Amendment. There's a protective aspect of the 14th Amendment that all states have to follow. Now, that is a provision that every state has to sign off on when they become a state of the union. They have to agree to be a part of America under our American Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land. They have to agree to abide by the 14th Amendment protections of all their inhabitants. The state of California, unbeknownst to a lot of attorneys, have moved away from that mechanism in a lot of case law under what's called their state interest. They create these bills and these propositions to say, well, we're not entitled to the 14th Amendment protection in California because we have a state interest that supersedes that. And nothing can be further from the truth. That is judicial corruption. That is treason. But they're getting away with it, and no one's calling them out on it, okay? And I've read some pretty horrific case law on the issue where the California Supreme Court has ruled, like in the case Gates versus Superior Court. Now, if you remember, if you lived in Los Angeles or probably not, who in the country missed this blip on the screen? Pursuant to the Rodney King riots, the L.A. riots, was due to Rodney King's civil trial. And it was a riot, and it was worldwide, 1991, 1992. During that time of the riots, a truck driver named Reginald Denny was traveling through some part of L.A., I think it's above the boulevard, and he got pulled out of his truck by a few black people, and he got beat to smithereens. Moments earlier, before he arrived at the intersection, there were police there guarding the streets. Daryl Gates, the then police chief, pulled them away from those intersections, and he made a declaration. Officers, you will not patrol the Latino and black neighborhoods. You will focus on the Caucasians. And a lot of these officers were bent out of shape over this call by Daryl Gates because they wanted to protect the community. And so a whistleblower came forward and said, you know what, we were at that intersection moments earlier, and he called us off. And as a reason for calling us off, this man almost died at the hands of mob violence. Well, some attorneys got together and decided they were going to sue the city of Los Angeles for Mr. Denny's injuries. And they sued him under the mob violence issue under a tort claims law and a civil rights violation, but they sued in state court. Well, the attorney for Mr. Gates and the local officials filed the main damage to have the court honor the rule of law. And we listened to this very carefully. Under state law, when you're suing in a state court and you're suing a state official, the state of California, a local official or local agent or local agency under state law for tort claims, they have absolute immunity from such suits because the Supreme Court of California ruled in Gates v. Superior Court, they're not required to follow the law in California. They're not required to give you police protection in California. If you're out there on the street and a police officer is dealing with you and you have a medical condition, let's say it's neurological seizures, if you go into a seizure while he's got you under a traffic stop or pedestrian stop, he has no legal duty to call medical or offer you medical attention or medical assistance. He has no legal duty to do anything, and you cannot sue him for it under California law in the state of California in a state court. And that's horrific to me, but the California Supreme Court ruled in the Gates versus Superior Court, they are immune from suit. Now, you would think under the 14th Amendment protections, they're required to protect your rights pursuant to the 14th Amendment. California, as a state, signed off on that amendment in 1959, okay, they were going to honor that. Now, of course, did California secede from the Union? No. That's called legislative corruption. So what you have to do when you're going to sue in California, a local official, any kind of bureaucrat, being local, state, cop, whatever, you have to take them to federal court. Because under state law, pursued in a state court, that's what? They have absolute immunity. But not in federal court under a federal claim of tort. I have access to one of the briefs that was written by an attorney. He will be nameless. He will remain nameless. I won't mention his name. And it got filed in a superior court in Los Angeles against SB 277. I read his brief, pretty much two causes of actions, First Amendment violation, kids entitled to a free education, and injunctive relief under Civil Code of Procedure 526 and 525 of California Civil Code. Well, Civil Code of CCP 525 and 526 is the equivalent of the federal injunctive relief statute, okay, under 2201 and 2202 in federal court. But he's using a California injunctive relief on the Civil Code Procedure 525, 526, but it's tort claim stuff. And he's in a state court proceeding, and he's suing the state of California. Well, guess what? He's going to find out real fast when the AG's office come back with their demur against this complaint, and they're going to say, they're going to make the allegation, he failed to make a legal claim to make his keep his case going forward. And the judge is going to rule against this attorney and dismiss his case, because he failed to allege a legal cause of action that can go forward due to the fact that the state of California is going to be deemed immune from suit on the state law in the state court.
Say that again. The last sentence you just said, would you repeat that?
I'll repeat that. This attorney is going to find out really, really quickly when the attorney general files the response to his complaint. It's going to be a demur. In the demur, the AG's office is going to make the legal claim that the case should be thrown out, basically, in layman's terms, because the plaintiff, this attorney, and the eight or so people on the complaint as plaintiffs have failed to make a proper legal claim against them. And the proper legal claim against them should be, like I said earlier, be placed in federal district court, not in a state court. Under state law, in a state court venue, under state claims, the state of California and all of its officials have absolute immunity pursuant to Gates versus Superior Court. So you can look up that case. It's very lengthy, but the Supreme Court of California flushed out all of those issues about government immunity under state law and the state court, like this cause of action. It's worth the read for those who have legal training.
Stop right there. In essence, if I am reading this correctly, for SB 277 to be allowed to stand, the state of California would have to secede from the federal government. Am I correct?
No. They have.
Okay.
The statement that I made was, every state of the union has signed off on the 14th Amendment that they were going to honor that equal protection of all the rights of all of its inhabitants. However, due to judicial and legislative corruption, the state of California, under state law, has moved away from that constitutional parameter under what's called a state interest.
So you're trying
interest.
To undo the corruption at the state level.
Well, no, I'm not. My case is not about that. I understand what venue I'm going to be going into. And what I'm saying is because of the corruption of trying to bring a tort claim against a state official or the state of California in a state court, precedent is going to rule the day. However, if I change venues and sue the same entities, the state of California, or any public official in federal court, not state court, under a federal cause of action, not a state cause of action, I can now have a legal claim and legal standing to make that case go forward. Because state law will not necessarily govern. It could, but if you allege all federal claims in a federal district court, the federal court has to hear those claims if they're valid claims and there's evidence to support the violations. So
now,
what I want to try and draw is a distinction.
Okay, but I just want to say this right now. In a federal court in New York, there was a case in terms of a woman wanting her religious exemption observed, and the federal judge said that states have the right to deny religious exemptions.
Well, that's not true. That's not true. Now, again, it depends upon it depends upon how the attorney postured that argument, and it also depends on whether he filed an appeal on that issue or not. Because here's the thing that I want people to remember. The United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land. No one in the American government can get away from that one. But due to judicial corruption and attorney incompetence, that gets thrown under the bus. So if you're in a federal court anywhere in America, a federal district court, alleging a First Amendment claim under the First Amendment, that federal judge has to recognize the supremacy clause with respect to that claimant's First Amendment claims. Now, if the case gets dismissed, it could be an issue of whether the argument that they raised was not a true First Amendment argument, and so forth cannot go forward, or there's no evidence that their First Amendment rights were violated, therefore it cannot go forward. But if you have evidence that the person's First Amendment rights were violated by some state or federal official, and if you pled the right cause of action with the right phraseology in that claim, then guess what? That claim should be litigated, and that claim should go forward. And if the judge doesn't let it go forward, then you have to either do one of two things. Either file an appeal with the appellate circuit of the federal court in that circuit, let the appellate court rule on the constitutionality of this judge's lack of knowledge on the supremacy clause and possibly appeal that way, because that's the supreme law of the land. So, but a lot of times these judges, state and federal, make an unlawful ruling because of bias and corruption. So you have to understand procedure to know how to deal with that corruption. You need to file an appeal. So the way I was taught to navigate our judicial system, because it's corrupt, never file a civil action unless you intend to file an appeal, because good chance that judge may not like you, may not like your cause of actions, and may not like who you're suing, and just erroneously rule against you because of those factors. Well, that's bias, that's prejudice, that's corruption. But that's the reality. So you have to be prepared to file your appeal, go over his head, and let his bosses say, nope, you're wrong, you did it wrong, remand it back down and do the right thing. So, yes, I haven't read the pleading, so I don't know what was pled, but if what you're telling me is true and they pled a true claim under the First Amendment religious protections, the judge was corrupt, they should file an appeal. Does that make sense?
I believe an appeal has been filed.
Okay.
I believe. I can't attest to that. But please do go on with what you were speaking of.
Okay. All right. So I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. There's going to be some people with legal training kind of poo-poo what I'm telling you about the supremacy clause. There's a case that took place back in the, I think, early 80s. I don't remember the date. It's called Bivens versus Six Unknown Narcotics Agents. Now, this was a federal matter where federal agents came in and battered around his door of Bivens, and they bolted away in his house without a warrant, and they cuffed him and cuffed his child, they cuffed his wife, all under the idea that he was drug trafficking. No, he wasn't, but they didn't have a warrant. They had no probable cause, but they arrested him, threw him in the county jail for a day or so, and later dropped off the charges. Well, Bivens sued these federal government agents in federal court under the Civil Rights Statute, Title 42, Section 1983, for violating his civil rights. Well, the district court said you can't sue the federal government. They have immunity. So like what California is saying in state court about their officials. Well, if they have immunity, that means our constitutional parameters are either null and void or have been superseded by some other mechanism. They haven't told us about it. Well, neither is true. It's called corruption. So Bivens had to file an appeal with the appellate court for his district. Appeals court said, no, the federal government has immunity. They have sovereign immunity. They haven't waived the right to immunity. You cannot sue them for tort claims. They have immunity. Well, they weren't satisfied with that. So the attorneys filed a brief to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, wait a minute. All the nonsense stops right here. And they ruled in summation, no one's above the law. The federal government cannot come in and violate someone's rights on the one hand and knowingly violate those rights and come back and say we have immunity to protect them for those violations. Our laws just do not work that way. So the United States Supreme Court overturned the appellate court district. They overturned the district court judge district, and they remanded the case down with damages to Mr. Bivens. Now, if you sue a federal agent or a federal agency on the civil rights and tort claims, you need to plead Bivens versus six unknown narcotics agents to show the court that you understand the precedented case law that governs breaking down federal agencies' immunity clause. Now, due to corruption, they didn't need Bivens to do that. Well, perhaps someone other than Bivens filed a wrongful claim or didn't plead it the right way and it got dismissed. It shouldn't have taken Bivens the energy and the effort to go all the way to the United States Supreme Court so they can say, we have what's called a federal or a national constitution that's in place. It is the supreme law of the land. Any agency, any citizen, any bureaucrat also comes under its authority. So you're not going to be on this in our country swearing an oath to uphold this constitution and at the same time behind the back violate those provisions and then say you have immunity. That just doesn't work in our country. So that being stated, I'm trying to draw the distinction between, you know, judicial corruption and what they'll make us do to get our remedy. So I'm aware of those kind of trap doors, okay? And I want the listeners to also be aware that there are trap doors. Now, my case against Pan is what's called a bifurcated action. It's a RICO / civil rights case. And what that means is it's a dual action under the Hobbs Act, under Title 42, Section 1983 for certain claims. So I've taken into account and taken several provisions rather to brace for judicial corruption. So there's some common law elements in these pleadings that the judge is not going to want to have to try and play around with. And because it's a racketeering case, racketeering cases are like vacuums. They're like a double-edged samurai sword. They cut both ways. So if there's any person in that court clerk office or any judge that hears or has to deal with this case, tries to derail it, dismiss it for some erroneous reason, they too could become a defendant in the next racketeering case. So Congress wrote the racketeering statute to sort of pierce the veil of trade unions, attorney firms, politicians, court systems, judges. Because they, at the time when they revamped it in 1972, they realized that this organized crime stuff, it was morphing from the mobsters, from, say, the alcohol issue to drugs, arms, bribing politicians so they can turn the other way. Congress saw it at that time as a systemic problem in our country, and it was derailing and debasing our economic system, our economic economy. So they wrote it in a liberal sense to bring to justice anyone who is discovered to be involved in interstate and foreign commerce violations by taking someone's liberty or taking someone's property or, you know, killing them, murder for hire, you know, child pornography, all those kinds of things can come under the Hobbs Act. Now, unless you're an attorney who's been studying RICO in the Hobbs Act, you're not going to get this stuff. This is specialty law, okay? So every attorney who looks at racketeering, their first knee-jerk reaction is, oh, you're talking about the Hobbs Act? Well, that's for mobsters. That's for those undercover crime figures. Yeah, originally it was drafted for that during the Al Capone days, but in 1972 it got revamped some more to include other elements. And so I'm using those elements as well with Senator Pan and all of his cohorts, okay? So there's it's a bifurcated action under RICO and Title 42 of Section 1983. Now, to the listeners and to yourself as well, one of the elements, one of the strongest elements to this case is what's called obstruction of justice and extortion of rights under color of right, color of law, rather. What Senator Pan has done and his cohorts, all the ones who supported this bill and voted for this bill, they all took an oath of office to uphold not only the California but the United States Constitution and all of the protective mechanisms that we as citizens are entitled to. The protective mechanism under the First Amendment, under the Fourth Amendment, under the Fifth Amendment, all of those amendments were in our protections due to their oath. And here's the catch-all. They took the oath of office to uphold the law, not us. The Constitution doesn't operate on us. It operates on them. It's a document that constrains their behavior, not ours. Our only obligation is to not trespass on someone's liberty or property. Yeah, that document is written for them. So that being stated, when they swear an oath, they're saying, I am going to protect all the inhabitants of the state of California from all enemies, foreign and domestic, and protect their rights, state and federal, as I do my duty in office. That's what I've been elected to do. Now, when you take into account these officials have gone behind closed doors and had secret meetings, and they've been lobbied by the drug companies to do the will of the drug companies, Big Pharma, what they have done, and most attorneys won't talk about this, is seditious conspiracy and treason against the state and the federal constitution. Pursuant to their oath, they have no authority to do that, to commit treason. The penalty for treason used to be hanging in the public square until you're dead, hanging by your neck. We can't do that anymore, but there's another way to do it civilly, and that's through racketeering cases. So their conduct in violating their oath to get this bill going through, and I don't care what kind of bill it is, this wouldn't have to be about vaccines. It could be about cars. It could be about watering your lawn. It doesn't make any difference. When they get together and violate the oath to those constitutional mandates, they've committed treason. And in a RICO case, that's called obstructing justice. Now, let me break that down for you. Obstruction of justice, when it comes to a court official or a legislator or judge, is the act of trying to derail justice as it was intended to go forward. They're trying to impede the due administration of the court or derail its efforts to find the truth. That is obstruction of justice. Here, specifically, when they violated their oath to support this bill, they were trying to corruptly influence the outcome of this bill getting passed or not getting passed. And so the secret door meetings, behind closed door meetings, and all these kind of shenanigans constituted obstruction pursuant to their oath. The other predicate act that I'm pleading is extortion of rights under color of law. What they're doing with this bill is they want to extort and force us to waive our First Amendment religious preferences to get our children vaccinated. In doing so, they want us to waive also our Fourth Amendment protections, because they're going to be using the little henchmen and affiliates like Child Protective Services, the local law enforcement individuals, superintendent of schools, the local health departments. They're going to be using those four little instruments as their little fingers to help enforce this mandate. So at some point in time, you may have a visit from a Child Protective Services, a superintendent of school, or a nurse who wants to see your medical chart and medical records. Well, that's a privacy issue between you and your physician. So they wanted us to waive that right of privacy to become, make it mandatory to comply with this bill. Now, that's a Fourth Amendment violation under privacy on the Fourth Amendment. Under the Fifth Amendment, this bill violates your right not to be, it says on the Fifth Amendment, your right to not have your property taken away without due process. Well, guess what? Your health comes under a property right. Your liberty comes under a property right. So Under the Fifth Amendment, you have a right not to be assaulted or killed by no matter what the circumstance is, right? By being a needle, being run over by a car, being hit by a sniper's bullet. You have the right not to be killed or maimed or injured in your health without due process of law. So it affects that amendment. Under the 14th Amendment, like I said earlier, you have the right to due process of law and equal protection of all the laws before you lose your rights or health. If they're going to make this bill, well, I would say, constitutional, they'd have to give you a hearing on the matter before they say you can't come into school and show and prove at this hearing that your child isn't healthy enough to be in school. Okay? Or say that,
I'm sorry. I have to go outside to get away from my dog because the mail person is on the block and he will bark nonstop.
Okay.
So just I really wanted to hear what you said last, but at this point I don't even
I can repeat it. I can repeat it.
Okay.
If they were going
to... Yeah, but I still won't hear it.
Okay.
You can repeat it for the audience. I just want you to know you have 9 minutes or maybe 8 minutes left. So, you know, you have to pace yourself. And I may not be able to hear you until the end of the show because of my dog.
Okay.
But so you just take it and run with it. And I will hear the end of the show myself, clearly, when I play it back, unfortunately.
Okay, very good.
So go ahead, Travis. Yeah.
Okay. So the two main racketeering causes of actions are obstruction of justice under 18 U.S.C. 1503, conspiracy to obstruct justice under 1962 of Title 18, where, you know, involved in a conspiracy, you don't have to know what you're doing is illegal to be guilty of a conspiracy. So that's going to stick in this case. You know, an extortion of liberty on the color of official right under 18 U.S.C. 1951. I've even used a conspiracy to unlawfully use biological weapons against the citizenry under 18 U.S.C. subsection 175 to 178 and the illegal use of chemical weapons against the citizenry. So these legislators are going to be sued under these mechanisms and a conspiracy to do all these things and induce their little cohorts, the superintendent of schools, the local health departments, the local law enforcement, child protective services, to help them in their racketeering enterprise. And that's how it's played in the complaint. Now, on the other side of the coin, on the civil rights aspect of it, there's a civil rights case and the common law jurisdiction issues as well that they're not going to be able to get away from, okay? They're just not going to get away from it. So this case is not going to be dismissed by judicial corruption because the judge finds that the judge is going to be a defendant in another racketeering case. They are not immune from prosecution. So right now I've got my mentor, Mr. Brown's organization, who was an attorney in Minnesota, looking at my pleading to make sure that I didn't miss anything. And he'll get back to me in a couple of days about what recommendations he recommends me modifying, if any. But I've done this a couple of times, and I'm pretty confident in my first draft that I didn't miss anything. So it's a multi-plaintiff suit. We've got about 28 plaintiffs, and we've got 50 defendants. And I was debating whether I was going to make this statement, but I found most of their spouses. So the spouse is going to be co-defendants as well for the spouses aiding and abetting their politicians' corruption in office. And the reason why I'm using the spouses is because I want to traumatize Pan and his cohorts. I want them to understand. Did you have a question? Sally, can you hear me? Well, if you can't hear me, I'll keep speaking. My objective was to traumatize them like a family unit. So that the spouse, when they get served this complaint, they're going to be wondering, geez, what did you do in office that my name is attached to this thing? This is pretty serious. And the spouses don't have the resources like their elected officials do. They have to hire private counsel. So it's going to cost them attorney's fees to defend this action. And now if I approach it from the level that the other attorney I mentioned his name approached it from, that won't teach Pan and his cohorts any lesson. I could have done a writ of mandamus last year and challenged this thing successfully, but that would not teach these guys a lesson. Making them a defendant in a racketeering case where their spouses are also on the hook for their corruption, now that's going to teach them a lesson. That's going to give them a life lesson that they'll think next time, maybe I might want to honor my oath to the Constitution and the people that I serve. Maybe I want to think about, what if I take this bribe from this lobbyist that represents a pharmaceutical company, I might find myself in more trouble than it's worth. So that's my objective, is to teach them a lesson that citizens need to rise up, use our First Amendment right to petition the courts for redress of grievances and come out to these guys in another way. Because voting clearly doesn't work. Holding a picket signing at the Capitol does not work. Trying to get FaceTime with these people does not work. But what does work is making their name a defendant in a civil suit for their obstruction of justice. That'll get their attention. Do you have any questions?
Well, no, I just came in at the tail end of this, and I have to tell you, very interesting, very interesting. So I missed a good 10 minutes there. So could you recap before we go off the air what the essence of what you are doing is?
Yes. How much time do I have?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'll recap by saying.
No. You have two solid minutes.
Okay. First and foremost, I didn't file my action in state court because of the corruption in state court. I filed the action in federal district court in Los Angeles. Okay. So I'm invoking all federal violations with all federal rules. I know the rules very well. So whomever attorney come into court to defend this action, I'm right there with them, blow to blow, toe to toe, nose to nose. I know exactly what I'm doing. And then they can't confuse me and they cannot intimidate me. So it's going to be in federal district court. It's a bifurcated action under Title 42, Section 1983, and RICO, 18 U.S.C. 1961, 1962, and 1964, for obstructing justice, racketeering, conspiracy to obstruct justice and racketeering, and the illegal use of biological weapons against the citizenry, the illegal use of chemical weapons against the citizenry, and a couple other charges. So there's total 16 different charges.
I have to ask, this is a very important question and certainly relevant. How do we, that they keep saying the science is settled? Because this is just a glaring lie. And
yes,
they have gotten away with literal murder because of this glaring lie.
Well, one of the ways that we have to do that is just keep talking about it and keep exposing it. You know, things like lawsuits like this, that where they have to have discovery and they have to have a meaningful conversation on the courtroom floor where there's open transparency, real evidence, and that exposes the fraud and the lies so that the truth can be told. We need media exposure. We need to be doing everything we can do to keep talking about this issue of the fraud of the CDC so that it gets out. The more we educate the public, the more outraged the public gets in mass, the faster we can overcome this CDC corruption and have a better leverage and dealing with these corrupt officials.
Okay. Well, this is the stumbling block that is, you know, seems beyond our control practically. It's unbelievable. When you know the ingredients and the diseases that result and the intent, and yet you cannot, under any circumstance, get Congress to act to protect the public health. It to me is the most startling thing in the whole wide world. You know,
right.
There's so much about waiting.
My next task is going to be to challenge and overthrow the Vaccine Injury Act of 1986. And I have a way of challenging that in federal district court. And I'm surprised attorneys hadn't thought about this, but perhaps their focus has been on the vaccine court in New York. That's a waste of time, in my opinion. It's totally unconstitutional.
Well, the FDA categorizes it not as a pharmaceutical drug, but as a health program. That, too, must be changed.
Here's the thing. It depends on how you attack it. So my opening brief, in this case, talks about the Tuskegee experiment. I think you know what that is, okay?
Of course.
Well, they use black folks as a test tube to determine the long term effects of syphilis untreated on their health program.
Half a minute.
Okay, on their health program.
Signal.
Okay,